Well, I guess the first thing I should ask you is, what is plagiarism?
Well, there's no clear definition, and that's one of the things the book tries to do, is come up with a definition. It takes different forms in different media, but literary plagiarism consists not so much in the lifting of a plot or the general configuration of a book. There are only so many plots in the world. Same way comedians will tell you there are only sort of 7 basic jokes. But what it really involves in literary matters is word for word, verbatim chunks of somebody else's material. What people don't do is configure words the same way by coincidence. They may configure the odd phrase the same way by coincidence, but when you start to see a couple of juicy sentences together that are identical, you know you've got plagiarism. Mm.
Well, you state in Stolen Words that plagiarism actually goes back. I don't know if you want to call it plagiarism, or maybe it was just borrowing or something, but you cite Virgil, Homer, Chaucer. Were they really plagiarists?
Not plagiarists. They were borrowers, but they were borrowers in a time when borrowing was not only acceptable, but was the normal method of literary production. In classical times, on up through the Renaissance, imitation was considered what was a poet's business. Things changed, and changed very quickly in the 17th century. It changed for a number of reasons, but it was at that time that the notion of ownership, the notion of originality as something important, as a positive literary value, took hold. And by the 18th century, writers were very, very touchy on the subject of plagiarism, whereas a couple of hundred years before that, it was not a matter that provoked tremendous amounts of dispute.
Well, one of the authors you cite is Lawrence Stern, known for Tristan Shandy. Tell me about that case.
Well, the paradox of Tristram Shandy is that it's one of the most original novels in the language by anybody's estimation. It is exceptionally inventive, and it is a kind of parody of the novel almost before the novel was invented. And yet, for all its inventiveness, there are chunks of Tristram Shandy that are verbatim plagiarisms from earlier works. And Stern has his defenders who say that these things were there so that readers would recognize them, that they constituted a kind of literary joke. But there are many passages that his readers clearly would not have known and were there not as jokes and not as parodies, but just to take a free ride upon. And his main quarry was Robert Burton, who wrote The Anatomy of Melancholy 100 years before that. And when Stern was accused of plagiarism, he wound up plagiarizing his apology for plagiarism from Burton, or plagiarizing what might be called his justification for it from Burton. So there was some game playing in Stern, but clearly some of it was just plain filching.
You also cite Samuel Taylor Coleridge,
mm-hmm.
and a very interesting section of the book deals with Charles Reed. I guess he's best known for The Cloister and the Hearth. But tell me about this case, because you cite a story that appeared in Harper's Magazine called The Picture. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, this was a story that he published very late in his life, and it was published in a couple of installments over here. And it was stolen from a French writer, a woman named Madame Charles Rabaud, who is no better known to us nowadays than Charles Reed really is. But the odd thing about Charles Reed is he had no need to steal it. He was a man who in his day was ranked by literary critics in Britain, by many of them anyway, as second only to Dickens in terms of importance. He had an immense reputation, a far greater reputation than she had. He had no monetary need to steal. He had no need to steal in order to advance his reputation and career, but he did it. And he was especially paradoxical, as actually, a lot of plagiarists are pretty paradoxical characters, but Reed also made part of his reputation as being one of the staunchest advocates of an international copyright law in his day, which seems like an odd thing for a plagiarist to be advocating. And yet he felt some compulsion, clearly, to take this. And you can get on his trail by going into his notebooks and checking out his letters, and you see pretty much what he did.
Apparently, he was the French were very vulnerable to him.
Mm-hmm. He was a great Francophile. He thought that the French were better to their authors than the English were, but he didn't really pay them much tribute by going after this French writer. But he was typical of a lot of plagiarists in that he really did not need to steal. And very often what you find about plagiarists, whether they're in academic life or whether they're in the entertainment world or whether they're in literary world producing fiction and criticism, is that they are generally people of some talent, and they don't do this like the poor student who panics and steals a term paper because he's, you know, going to flunk the course or is not going to get it in on time. They do this very often for other reasons. Very often they are people of talent and people who are capable of producing good work on their own, but something makes them want to go after other people's work. One of the ironies in the campaign a couple of years ago, when Senator Biden was very publicly accused of taking other people's speeches, is that Biden, among the pack of Democratic candidates, was almost universally regarded as the best orator, the best speaker. And it wasn't a reputation he got on the basis of stealing other people's speeches. He is a good orator. He had better speech-making skills than most of them did. And yet he was very light-fingered.
Yeah, I think you cite some passages in there. He cribbed from the British Labor Party leader, Neil Kinnock, I think his
name
is.
That's right.
And I think you have some examples in there, and they're very similar. He could have simply said something to the effect, my story is similar to Kinnock's story, right?
Right, but again, it was word for word. I mean, you know, if you compare political speeches, they all deal in some of the same cliches, but it's when you see the same type, the same word, sentence after sentence after sentence, that you know something is going on. The other thing about Kinnock's speech is that it was a particularly good one. It wasn't simply, you know, your garden variety political speech that puts you to sleep. It was very, very vivid. And what Biden did was sort of translate some of the particulars of it into his own biography and his own American experience. You know, Kinnock says he asked why he and his wife were the first members of their families to go to university, which is a British phrase. And so Biden wouldn't reproduce that, but he would reproduce the same series of comparisons, you know. And he got caught. I mean, all political speeches are plagiarized to the extent that they're all written by speechwriters. And the man who's delivering them as his own words almost never has written them. But that's an accepted convention. It's when the speechwriters begin stealing from other politicians that you've got a problem.
Well, there's a ironic portion in Jacob Epstein's novel, Wild Oats. I hadn't read the novel, but you describe a college professor who discovers that two of the students in his class have plagiarized, I think it's Dickens, an essay on Dickens?
A paper that ultimately, or originally, was written in one of these term paper mills, one of these places that students can order papers from. They still exist and flourish even. That's the origin of that paper. But in this novel, what is curious is that the subject of plagiarism forms part of the plot. And you would think that somebody who is lifting passages in his novel would avoid that subject as a plot motif for all he was worth. But again, this is part of the paradoxical nature of plagiarists, that they seem to do, like Charles Reed being an advocate of international copyright, things that you would not expect them to do. They very often don't cover their tracks. They very often seem to highlight what they've done. There's a wonderful essay on this subject by a man named Peter Shaw. If you write a book on this subject, you have to be very careful to cite everybody. You have to be very pure because you don't want to be doing it yourself. And Peter Shaw, in his article on plagiarism, which is excellent, talks about some of this, explores the notion of what one person, Martin Amis, called the death wish that he sometimes thinks plagiarists have. And Peter Shaw compares the crime to kleptomania. Kleptomania is usually an upscale crime. The people who do it don't need what they steal. They're generally pretty well-heeled, and it's a kind of compulsion. And this is true of a lot of plagiarists. I mean, the plagiarists who are written about in this book, whether it's Lawrence Stern or Coleridge or Charles Reed or Jacob Epstein, these are all people of considerable ability. But something in them made them go after other people's work, even when they didn't need it.
Well, tell me about this Epstein case. I just interviewed his father last week. You know, he has this big book, which is called, what is it called?
The Reader's Catalog.
The Reader's Catalog. Yeah. We talked about, we didn't talk about his son, of course, but what was this incident involving Epstein?
Well, it happened about 10 years ago. Jacob Epstein, who was quite young, in his early 20s, published a novel called Wild Oats, which was a perfectly respectable first novel, and showed a good deal of talent, his own talent. But about a year after it was published, to pretty good notices, it was discovered that it contained lots of plagiarized lines from the British novelist Martin Amis. And Martin Amis eventually blew the whistle on young Jacob Epstein in The Observer, the British paper. And it was a very peculiar case, and it was one that was lapped up with a lot of relish by media in New York because of Jacob Epstein's very prominent parents. Jason Epstein, his father, the editorial director of Random House, and his mother, Barbara Epstein, one of the co-editors of the New York Review of Books. And what added to the oddity of the case is that the person he elected to plagiarize, Martin Amis, was himself a kind of literary kid, the son of the famous British novelist Kingsley Amis, the author of Lucky Jim. And so the case was a natural for people to, literary people, really to get interested in and wonder what was going on. And so it became, you know, within the publishing world, a small media storm.
Yeah, well, I made the New York Times, too. Well, but Jacob did, I understand, a credible job of writing on his own. I wonder why he borrowed so many passages from Amis.
Well, this is one of the mysteries. Plagiarists very often plead inadvertence. Sloppy note-taking is one of the standard pleas that they make. They will say that, you know, their reading notes got conflated with their writing notes, and they forgot that what was on their notepad was not their own stuff, but was somebody else's. And this is a fairly standard defense. You see it being made by people accused of plagiarism really in all fields. There's a chapter in this book about an academic case, a historian who was found to have plagiarized an awful lot of stuff, going back to his dissertation and through most of the articles that he wrote while he was an assistant professor. And sloppiness was his defense. But it's really a defense that doesn't wash very well in most of these cases when you look at it, because you often see that what happened wasn't sloppy at all. The plagiarist took some pains to change little bits and pieces of what he was taking so that it would fit into the context of the book he was producing. And when you hear that defense, it's I think one of the signals you should get to look further, look into it, because it often falls apart.
Well, Jacob hasn't written a book since that time. Even if he writes another novel, do you suppose he would have a hard time getting it published? I mean, say the novel's good, based on his reputation as a plagiarist.
Well, I don't really know. I have no idea. He has flourished. He has gone on to a career in television and has been very much involved with Hill Street Blues and L.A. Law, and is a person of some consequence now out in Hollywood.
But it's all right to plagiarize in Hollywood and in television.
Well, I don't think he's done that, but this one-shot literary experience is receding further into the past. I don't know. Perhaps, you know, he will come back and write another novel. But I don't want to speculate on his motives, but I think that his career probably has taken a very different route from the one he expected it to follow.
Might be better. You know, I mean,
certainly better paid, probably.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Writers are not known for making a lot of money from their books, unless you're a Sidney Sheldon or something like that. Well, you had mentioned about these outfits that provide term papers. Tell me, I remember when I was a kid, I don't think we had Cliff Notes and things like that, but I used Classic Comics a lot, Classic Illustrated, you know. They were terrific. You know, they really helped you limp through classes. You know, if you ever had to read The Last of the Mohegans, Classics Illustrated was a big help. But actually, there are outfits that create term papers.
Mm-hmm. They have files of papers, and they have catalogs. And you can look up the subject you need a paper on and order that paper. And beyond that, with some of them, you can custom order papers. You know, you can pay somebody at one of these outfits to actually compose a new paper for you. And they're pretty sleazy operations. There's one of them that lists really thousands of titles, and then toward the edge of the page of the catalog, it has a series of digits telling you how many pages the paper has, how many footnotes are in it, how many sources are cited, you know. So presumably the sort of wretched student that uses this kind of service, you know, is going to be impressed if it's a high number of footnotes and a high number of sources. Well, that must indicate quality, you know. And they go along these outfits, and every once in a while they get caught up in court cases. There have been attempts to legislate them out of existence, but they always crop up.
They can't do that. Can you get a little closer?
Sure.
They can't really do that under the First Amendment. I mean, anybody can write a paper, can't they?
Well, there are certain statutes that have been enacted in some states that have been able to put some kind of specific limitations on these outfits, but it is very difficult because they can claim that they are only offering papers that the student should use as, you know, background research to help him in the production of his own paper. Everybody knows that what is going on is that the student is ordering a paper that he is going to submit word for word. And, I mean, some of them very disingenuously send the student papers that have a little copyright notice printed on them, and all that means is that the poor kid has to retype the paper, aside from shelling out to buy, you know, this crummy piece of work that's not his own and that he shouldn't be buying in the first place. Because they are trying to get around the law, he's got to do at least a little typing of his own.
Well, he could scan it, put it in a computer, and then just make alterations and have it printed out.
Well, the new technologies are going to make for new techniques of plagiarism. There's no question about that. And plagiarism is, I think, likely to flourish with some of the new technologies. I think that it will. These techniques will assure plagiarism's future. There are some people who argue that the new technology will also aid in the detection of plagiarism, but I wouldn't be quite as certain of that.
But say some moronic football player passes in a 25-page paper with all of these footnotes and a big bibliography. I mean, how many professors are going to be fooled by that?
Well, I think good ones, good professors, very few of them would be fooled. But, you know, it often isn't quite as wholesale as that. I mean, what will happen is a student will write a very weak, shabby paper of his own and then pump it up with, you know, paragraphs and particular bits that were derived from another source. And, you know, it may be that there's enough weakness in the paper to make it plausible as a production of that student. But part of it is clearly plagiarized, and part of it the student has no business submitting.
Well, I guess I'm guilty of plagiarizing myself. I recall back in college I did a paper on Lillian Hellman for one class, and I was running very late. I had to do another paper for another class, and I decided since the class, I think one was in English and the other was in theater, And so I realized I could probably use the same topic for the theater class as well as the English class. So I retyped the Lillian Hillman paper that I had written, and I submitted it to this second professor. I was scared, you know, I was nervous in case these guys ever bumped into each other. Mm-hmm. Strangely, I got an A on the English and a C minus with theater. So I don't know what I did wrong in the copying the paper the second time. But the professor, that second professor, didn't like my paper at all.
He may have bumped into the first professor. that may be the reason for
well,
you.
No,
C-minus.
He would have flunked me. I think. Yeah. Don't you think?
Quite possibly.
That's not too ethical to do, is it?
No, but
it was still my own work, though.
Mm-hmm. I mean, self-plagiarism is probably a bit more forgivable, than stealing somebody else's stuff. I mean, this is sort of double dipping, and a lot of it goes on. It's different to be pulling the wool over the professor's eyes than it is to be ripping off some writer who's likely to remain completely unaware of it. But, you know, students generally plagiarize for reasons different from the reasons professional writers plagiarize. Students do it because they are very often making a conscious decision to try to get away with something. They panic, as the dean I interview in the book says, and they see plagiarism as a means to an end. Mm-hmm. They've got to get the paper in, so they'll plagiarize it. And it's unpleasant, it's shameful, and they may or may not later feel guilty about it, but they don't have the sort of compulsion to plagiarize as an end in itself that you see among some of these professional writers, professional academics, who are people of talent. You know, again, the people who occupy most of this book are people who really didn't need to do this as a means to an end. And what you realize after a while when you see some of the same people doing it again and again is that plagiarism...
Comment.
Sure.
Can't have that.
Upstairs.
Yeah. Scoot in a little
sure.
closer.
Sorry.
I want to ask you. Oh, wasn't there a case where somebody got a novel written by Saul Bellow and submitted it under a pseudonym, and it was rejected?
I don't know this. This case. There are cases of writers themselves who have established writers who have tried their luck. Or tested the system by submitting some of their own work under pseudonyms and seeing if they're only flourishing because of their reputations. I don't really know the Bellow case. It seems to me I have heard
maybe
something.
It wasn't Bellow, but it was similar. Yeah. Well, the great English writer. Oh, gosh, why am I having a mental block? And I've interviewed her, too. She wrote The Good Terrorist and... You know, the novel Good Terrorist, and one of her best novels. Oh, why am I having a mental block? She's world famous, been mentioned for the Nobel. Well, it'll come back to me.
Yeah.
I'll bring it up. Why am I having a problem?
I think of Doris Lessing.
Doris Lessing.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Yeah.
I couldn't think of the name. Yes, Doris Lessing did that just a couple of years ago. She submitted a novel under a pseudonym to her regular publisher who rejected it. It was subsequently submitted to another publisher who did pick it up.
Uh-huh.
It's incredible, isn't it? Well, let's go on a little bit. The movie, Falcon Crest, the television show, Falcon Crest. There was a charge of plagiarism involving that. What was that case about?
This is a very sad case, I think. It has elements of comedy in it, but there was an immense lawsuit involving this television series that was brought by a writer named Anita Clay Kornfeldt, who wrote a novel called Vintage, which was set in the California wine country, which is, of course, the setting for this long-running nighttime soap opera, Falcon Crest. And Mrs. Kornfeld had plans or hopes to have her novel turned into a miniseries, but while those plans were hatching, CBS put Falcon Crest on the air, and her assumption was that they had plagiarized her work. And she sued, and this case was litigated fiercely in Los Angeles back in the summer of 84 with, you know, the usual years of depositions and so forth preceding it. And she lost. And I think the judge was correct in finding against her. I don't think plagiarism occurred. I think this was a case of two people getting to the same milieu at roughly the same time. If you look for the very small details that would indicate plagiarism, the kind of verbatim reproduction of words and so forth didn't really exist there. It may have looked close in places because television works in some of the same kinds of popular cliches that popular fiction does. But a thorough examination, I think, shows that there wasn't plagiarism there. But this case really took its toll on everyone concerned, and the creator of Falcon Crest was Earl Hamner, who was the creator of the Waltons, who had a particularly good reputation in Hollywood. And he was very wounded by these charges, and he had all of CBS's lawyers behind him. Mrs. Kornfeld hired Melvin Belli's office to represent her, and they fought it out. And each side hired a literary expert to prove its case. The plaintiffs had a literary expert who said that the Falcon Crest pilot, which is what the case hinged on, could not have been produced without Mrs. Kornfeld's work. And the defense had a literary expert that said it was ridiculous to think that there was any kind of lifting from her novel. Both of these experts were members of the UCLA English Department, who have offices a few doors down from one another on the same corridor. And they were taking exactly opposite sides, came to exactly the opposite conclusion. They're also very good friends. But you couldn't get them to agree on what had happened here.
So she lost her case.
She lost her case, and it took a big toll on her, because I think that she made this accusation very sincerely. She really believed that there was plagiarism that had occurred. I am certain that she didn't make it for venal reasons. You know, she wasn't trying to make a killing off something. She did it as a matter of pride and sincere belief. And I liked her enormously when I spoke with her. And I think she's a person of some ability who works really hard. And it was very tough for her to lose, as I'm sure it was very tough for Earl Hamner to be accused. And so this enters into the book because part of the history of plagiarism is the history of sincerely made but finally false accusations of it. And one of the things I tried to show with this was the toll that litigation in a matter like this can take on everybody involved.
Just one second. Sure. See if I can ferret out those pounders. Mm-hmm. It's not very loud, but I may not even get on the tape. Rob's in another floor.
Yeah, it sounds as if it's coming up from underneath, but I'm not certain.
Sure. I don't think it'll mar the tape much. There was a case recently, John Hersey, in an article that he mm-hmm. wrote in the New Yorker, and I can't remember what the topic was, but at any rate, he did admit that by an error he did plagiarize.
Yeah. That's a case I don't know too much about, and so I'm going to stay clear of that.
Well, that's
one.
Really sad, though, because Hersey is just a phenomenal writer over mm-hmm. many, many years.
You know, I don't mean to say either that inadvertence never occurs. I mean, I do think there are cases where people make mistakes, and I'm not talking about moral mistakes. They are sloppy, you know, just in their work, and something may find its way into their work that really should be cited. But where this, I don't know anything really much about the Herzi case, but where the defense becomes risible is when it's made by people who, you know, have to justify sometimes scores of instances in this way. You know, oh, I was sloppy there, and I was sloppy there, and, it, you know, it's sort of like the old joke about the defendant in the criminal case, you know, who says that the guy fell on the knife by accident, and the judge leans over and he says 27 times, you know.
What about, you mentioned D.M. Thomas, the White Hotel. What was that story?
He was accused by some reviewers of having plagiarized some Russian poetry that went into the novel. And his basic claim, as I understand it, was that the material was acknowledged in a kind of general way near the beginning of the book, but there are people who claim that by the time readers got to the place in the book where it was actually used, a reader would not be mindful of the fact that this was somebody else's work, that it was integrated into the text in such a way that it was clearly being passed off as his own.
Wasn't he cited also for his descriptions of Babi Yar?
Mm-hmm. And he's been in trouble a number of times. Again, this is not a case I know well, and it sort of receives a mention in the book. But it's come up in his career a couple of times. And
The White Hotel was a very original piece of work. I mean, I do remember reading that. I read the, I can't remember the author of Babi Yar. Remember the author? I think it's in there somewhere. Yeah. But I did read Babi Yar many years ago, and I believe that Thomas's descriptions are probably very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he did use it as a source. But The White Hotel was such a wonderfully crafted book, and a very unusual one, and a very original one, that it's kind of hard to accept the fact that any of it was plagiarized.
Yeah, this is... what he's said to have taken is Kuznetsov's memoirs of Babi Yar. And, you know, again, you can have, I'm not passing judgment on the Thomas case because it's not one that I studied in any depth, but you can have plagiarized passages lurking within a very original book. The classic case of that, I think, is Tristram Shandy, which remains... fantastically original book, one of the landmarks in the history of English fiction, but there are portions of it that are lifted and are not lifted for any purpose of parody. They're lifted so that the reader thinks they're Stearns.
Well, I published a book last year that I was kind of worried about because it was a novel centered around H.L. Mencken. Mencken's a character in the book, and there's dialogue that expresses Mencken's opinions politically and philosophically all the way through it. And I rewrote it. I mean, I lifted it from Mencken's work. I mean, the book has a plot and characters, and Mencken is only one of a number of characters in there, although he's instrumental in solving a literary crime. But I did want to have, I did trace Mencken's life, and so he communicates to a book dealer on Fourth Avenue, and they talk and dialogue, and the book dealer is very liberal, and Mencken is very conservative. Actually, he's a libertarian, and they fight all the time. And so the review in the Baltimore Sun said that I just lifted the dialogue right out of Mencken. Well, they're right in some respects, but I rewrote it in order to make it work as dialogue. So there wasn't any one line there that was exactly Mencken's. But what do you do if you're using a real character and you want to express his thoughts? I mean, how would you do it? I mean, then why use him at all?
Anybody who's writing historical fiction has to have a certain amount of license. I mean, think of the number of novels and miniseries in which presidents of the United States appear and, you know, various historical characters. And certainly they're going to wind up speaking dialogue that is meant to be plausible and has to be researched, has to gain its plausibility from some real source. And I think there, this is a different story because a certain amount of license has to be granted the writer because this is the production of a work of fiction. And, nobody is, you're not claiming by writing it that you are, passing off something that really happened. You're saying it might be plausible that Mencken spoke a version of these words that he wrote at another time.
No doubt he did.
But I think this is a very different matter from, somebody lifting passages and claiming them as their own.
Right. Now, I was careful, too. I put an acknowledgments page right at the very beginning, listing all the books that I read in order to get this Mencken dialogue.
I mean, I think that this is a staple of historical fiction. I mean, there have been novels about Oscar Wilde, for instance, that can't resist putting some of his own epigrams into the dialogue, things that he uttered or wrote on one occasion or another. They're too good for the novelist not to use. But I think any reader who picks up historical fiction knows the conventions of the genre to some extent and realizes that the author has got to find his material somewhere.
I think you also cite John Gardner, don't you? He wrote a book about Chaucer, and apparently there were passages that were lifted. What was that? You remember that?
Yes, this was a case that happened a number of years ago, and the defense that sometimes gets made of people in that situation, there was a case involving Gail Sheehy, which was similar. The notion that these writers were popularizing more esoteric material, that John Gardner was popularizing material on Chaucer that was, somewhat dry and scholarly. I think this entered into the defense. And these people have had their defenders, but they have also had the accusations of them carry some weight. And I think in Gardner's case, the accusations did some damage to his reputation.
Yeah, I hope he listed his sources, though. That would always help, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm. The Gardner case, again, is not one I treat in detail, but what sometimes happens is that writers will get into trouble because they do list sources. They do list a kind of general indebtedness to something, but then when they begin to draw on it specifically, they don't give indication that they're taking direct quotation at any given moment. I'm not saying this is exactly what happened in Gardner's case, but I've certainly run across cases like this, particularly in academic writing, where the writer will cite one source amidst a great many others, and so you know that he's drawn on it, but you don't know exactly where or when or how much. And what a plagiarist using that method sometimes does is wind up, quoting directly from it with no quotation marks. It's not enough to footnote that material. If it's a direct quotation, it's got to be in quotation marks. And so people can be, rather can disguise a kind of light-fingeredness in their methodology. Sometimes.
Well, you cite one really big case of the Alex Haley Roots case, and he that went to trial. He lost, didn't he?
Well, I think there was an out-of-court settlement that was paid in that case, but it was a fairly large sum. And again, the defense in this case was essentially sloppiness, that while he was working, people were coming up to him and giving him stories and giving him sources and things, and that stuff got mixed up. And in a case like Roots, there was an immense amount of money involved because the book was so successful, the television series was so successful. One of the real problems, I think, with plagiarism when it occurs in, say, an academic setting, is that very often it'll be one professor taking words from another professor, and there are not great sums of money at stake. I mean, professors don't make an awful lot of money out of the scholarly books they publish. And so it's a matter of stealing somebody's reputation, taking a free ride on somebody else's expertise. And there is often not a very clear remedy for that. But you can bet that the professor whose book made him all of $200 feels every bit as wounded when he's stolen from as a Hollywood power or a highly popular commercial writer feels when his words have been lifted.
Well, Thomas Mallon, my last question to you, how do I know that Stolen Words wasn't plagiarized?
I think you're just going to have to check the footnotes.
Well, you got them.
There are many.
Oh, boy, yeah, it's well documented. Very interesting book. I enjoyed it immensely. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.